Hear your honor.
The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to the second case of the day, the United States versus Dumasi. Mr. Durkin.
May it please the court, Mr. Peters, Mr. Fleischner, and I think the Justice Department is here as well. I welcome them to our court. In light of the time I have, I'd like to keep my comments primarily to our argument about the Baghdad file and subsumed in that the Confrontation Clause issue, which kind of goes hand in glove with that, and the sufficiency of the evidence. But before I get into that, I want to make some general comments that I think are relevant to the overall argument, and first explain how we became involved in this case. We did not try the case in the district court, so I may not be as familiar with the record as I normally would be. But my first exposure to this case was in the Tribune. And I thought it was a weak case when I read about it in the Tribune, and I was not dissuaded of that opinion from reading the transcript. We got hired. Our only appearance in the district court was very briefly. The family hired us just before some sentencing hearing dates after the government had sought the terrorism enhancement. And we filed a motion to come into the case in the district court and asked for time to delay the sentencing. Judge Conlon sensed why we were there and said, of record, if you're only here for the terrorism issue, I've already made up my mind, I'm going to rule on that. We discussed that with Mr. Dumasi and then decided not to enter our appearance. So that's our only involvement in the district court. But I think the significance in that is that I think this is one of these war on terror cases, and they tend to take on lives of their own. And a general problem that I see in this case is what I would call the pushing of the envelope that has been going on in the district court for a while. For want of a better term, I refer to it, I don't mean it disrespectfully, of kind of harmless error jurisprudence. But you know, the government in the district court, from my experience, seems to take the position that, you know, harmless error means green light, not red light. This case, I think, is a classic example of that, in the sense that normally, and in fairness to the government, they frequent, and in fairness to this court, no doubt, in a lot of cases, there is an overwhelming amount of evidence, and therefore a lot of the particularly evidentiary issues are harmless. The one thing I think we can all agree on is that in this case, that's not the case. This Baghdad file, I think, is clear from the government's response to the sufficiency argument. Without this Baghdad file, they have no case. So this is not a harmless error case. The other thing that I find intriguing is that both sides essentially say Judge Conlon was wrong. We say she was wrong under 807. Government says, well, she was probably right under 807, but she was wrong under 804 and 801. I find that intriguing. To make my point on this, to kind of from the district court standpoint, I'd like to pay particular attention to Judge Conlon's ruling the day before, and this goes in direct response to the government's argument that somehow we waived, or the Dumasi's counsel waived the authenticity argument in the district court. I don't really know how the government can make that claim, but if you take a look at our appendix A1, you have Judge Conlon's ruling on January 5th. It's a minute order with an order on the back. Actually, it's the second page in ours. But this ruling is made on January 5th, the day before the trial starts. And if you look at the second paragraph, she says, the government offers several persuasive reasons for deferring admissibility decisions concerning the Baghdad file until trial. And there's no dispute that, and she says in here, that the the defense in the trial court had filed a motion in limine with respect exactly to authenticity. Given the present situation in Iraq, the government faces enormous burdens in securing and authenticating Iraqi intelligence records. The government represents that it continues to use its best efforts to secure foundational testimony and has submitted evidence of its efforts. It points out that the distinctive characteristics in the appearance and contents of the documents, as well as the consistency of information contained in the documents with independent evidence, including DeMacy's own admissions, establish that the Baghdad file is authentic. So as late as the day before trial, we're still talking about authenticity, and we're still talking about a deferred ruling. And that's exactly how the court rules several days later, at trial on the issue. So I'm at a loss to understand the government's position that we've either waived or forfeited that.
Since you mentioned authentication, with respect to that issue, why isn't Sargon a witness with knowledge that the documents in the file were IIS documents?
There's no question that Sargon is a witness who can testify to knowledge about some of the documents. He says that. And I don't have a problem with some of the documents. The problem I have, and this is the problem that I wanted to... For a long time, I kept scratching my head and trying to figure out what's really wrong here. The problem, as I see it, is that the statement, if you will, under 807 that we're talking about is not necessarily the particular statements in each document. I concede that they might have been able to introduce the handwritten statements of DeMacy. The statement, however, and this is where I think you have to focus, the real statement at issue here is the statement that this file was found in Baghdad. That's the statement that they're really offering by means of this all being together in this binder. Now, there's all kinds of problems, as we pointed out, with that binder. Sargon, and I think you can take Sargon's testimony both ways. Government says, well, he has knowledge. Well, you bet he has knowledge. One of the things he says is that they're supposed to have paper, or they're supposed to have thread. All the documents are supposed to be bound by thread. These documents aren't bound by thread. One thing that's unequivocal is that Sargon himself, the man with knowledge, says, I've never seen a blue folder. We wouldn't keep something in a blue folder. He points to several other inconsistencies. He identifies the paper. I mean, I thought this was almost comical. He identifies the paper as appearing to be the paper, but the reason that he identified the paper is, the reason I can identify this paper is that it's in all different sizes and shapes, and we used all different sizes and shapes of paper. I mean, just kind of almost comical. But I don't concede that some of the documents could have come in. The problem is, and this is, if you will, the government pushing the envelope, in my opinion, the real relevance and the horse that they beat, or the drum that they beat, or the horse they rode, for want of a better analogy, all through this trial is this came from Baghdad. And that's where, we hyperbolically said in our opinion, or our reply brief, what if this had been found in a garbage can in Boise, Idaho, or better yet, outside the defendant's apartment? For all you know, on this record, that document could have been found in Boise or behind the defendant's backyard. And the real meaning that the government gets out of this, and the only way they make their case, is by saying, see, he must have been an agent because all these documents got to Baghdad. And the real linchpin of that is the phone records. They say, oh, but the other thing we point out, which ought to be a question to somebody, which never got addressed to my satisfaction in the district court, which we pointed out in both of our briefs, I believe, certainly the reply, the phone record, there's a recorded phone conversation in May with this woman, Zwafa or whatever her name is, and the FBI is getting her to try to get DeMacy to admit that he sent the documents to Baghdad. He says, I don't know where they came from. But we're talking about May. There's no question that that's a tape-recorded phone call made from, I think, the Dirksen building or the FBI building downtown on May 1st. And yet, Andrews, the guy in Baghdad, the Defense Department guy, says, I didn't get these records until January. I'm sorry, June. So I don't understand that. I don't know how that can be if these are the same records and they truly did get to Baghdad. But more importantly, and I think it goes to our Confrontation Clause issue, and I realize I'm asking, I'm pushing the envelope there, but I think with good reason, you can't cross-examine Andrews about where those documents came from. And that's the real question, because he's only an agent if they can prove this is what got to Baghdad. There's no question he was listed as a source, not an agent. I mean, that's another thing that I think goes to the admissibility argument as well. But I think, and if you also take a look at Judge Conlon's ruling under 807, it ultimately becomes circular. She really buttresses it by saying, well, there's some evidence of reliability, and after all, there really isn't anything else we can do. She says something like, you know, because of the breakdown of in Iraq and the destruction that is incurred with the Iraqi institutions, they don't have the opportunity to go through proper channels to authenticate. So they can't do it. Therefore, since they can't do it, oh well. And that's how I read that, with all due respect. And one,
Mr. Durkin, does the record reflect where Mr. Andrews received the file?
Yeah, he says he received it in Baghdad from this guy, I think it's Kazim or Kareem. He says he received the documents, but there's no testimony with respect to where they came from. There's a lot of testimony about general practice and that they were destroying documents and don't forget, we pointed out that this Kareem is somebody from the Iraqi National Council, which is the infamous Ahmed Shalabi, who not too long after that falls out of disfavor with the government and ends up he's getting charged for counterfeiting, which I think is kind of curious, which we pointed out in our brief. But these are people that have an axe to grind. I mean, this isn't not only is it not the Iraqi government and the proper channels under 3505, but you've got people that have an axe to grind with anybody who had anything to do with Saddam Hussein, you know, for better or worse. So I'm the point, and again I go back to what the real issue was, in my opinion, was the government's ability to argue that since Andrews says I received these in Baghdad, therefore these must have come from Baghdad. And that's a leap to go that far. And that's where I don't think anybody can say these are records. And they say one other thing we didn't point out in our reply brief, but it goes along with this 3505. They pointed out a case to you regarding the co-conspirator exception. I think it's Squilla Coates, S-Q-U-I-L-L-A-C-O-T-E. And they cited a reference to page 536. And I don't dispute that. That's just on the issue of whether somebody it could be the real person. But in the argument just before that, you have to note that these documents came from East Germany. They were authenticated. If you take a look at page 561 on, headnote 17 on in the West edition, they admit in that case that they were authenticated by the certificate from the East German government. So that case almost supports us instead of is against us. So I see the light is on.
Well, just one other thing. With regard to Mr. Sargon and what he said in support of authentication, is it your position, Mr. Durkin, that his recognizing code symbols and signatures of fellow officers is just insufficient?
Yes, and the code, as I understand it, came the code that they referred to, which is almost laughable. I wanted to talk about that for a minute. The code, as I understand it, those 10 words, that didn't come from the Baghdad file. That came from a consensual search at DeMasi's apartment. I think the only code was with respect to the symbol Sirhan, if that's what you mean. But,
well,
you know, yes, I think it's inadequate. Again, it goes to what I started out with, is that I don't have a quarrel with some particular documents coming in. I think they may have been able to authenticate, or not authenticate, but at least, you know, there might be some indicia of reliability of a couple of the documents. But the government not going to be able to tell you with a straight face they could have lived with just a couple of the documents. The documents without the binder, without it all being put together, without it looking like it was part of the Iraqi intelligence service, is meaningless. And it wouldn't have mattered. They couldn't possibly have carried the day without that. But, and if I could, because I think the code is hilarious. I mean, and it speaks to the sufficiency of the evidence argument. It's one of their arguments that there's other independent evidence aside from the Baghdad file. You look at these 10 words, and it's laughable. Abu Muhammad, father, New York home, taking things, advertisements, important items, the wedding, threat, inoperable car. If that's a code, then they don't have a lot to communicate with each other about, because I don't know how you take, first of all, I don't even know which is the code and which is the real word. I take it, since they say in their brief that Abu Muhammad was an official of the IMUN, that chart they have on page 10 of their brief, I guess the code words are on the right-hand side. And I guess it would read as something like, the inoperable car went to the wedding with advertisements that were taken home by the father, or some such thing, which would mean there were threats, important items, taking things in New York from Abu Muhammad. I mean, I just think it's kind of laughable to suggest that somehow that's a piece of strong corroborative evidence that would support this verdict without the Baghdad file. I think this is a very, very weak case, and okay. I think they pushed the envelope.
Thank you, Mr. Durkin. Ms. Peters.
Your Honor, I don't think there's any pushing of the envelope. I think Judge Conlon's rulings throughout this case were careful, considered, and based upon the law. With respect to the authentication issue with the Baghdad file, Government Exhibit 14, it's our position that certainly Judge Conlon's ruling permitting the jury to see evidence and decide what weight to give it was based upon a correct interpretation of Rule 901, which governs authentication and which requires a witness with knowledge. Certainly, Mr. Sargon was a witness with knowledge. He did testify at trial that, with respect to this file, he was a 24-year veteran of the Mukhabarat. He said that, with respect to this file, he recognized symbols, codes, abbreviations, and various code words for the different directorates of the IIS, as well as the signatures of some of his fellow Mukhabarat officers.
And specifically, did he identify more than one code or symbol?
Yes.
Contrary to what Mr. Durkin has suggested, it's just one. I gleaned from your brief there was more. I think
Mr. Durkin was responding to questions regarding code words. I think that he thought you were asking about the piece of paper that was found during the search of Mr. DeMacy's residence, in which there was a piece of paper mm-hmm. which the government said was code words. Now, with respect to what was in the Baghdad file, Mr. Sargon identified code words for the names of various Mukhabarat directorates. There were many directorates within the Mukhabarat, and there were code words for more than one. And I think it's interesting, Your Honor, when you look at the Mr. Sargon's testimony, he identified half a dozen other files of the Mukhabarat relating to transfers of different Mukhabarat personnel, and all of those came in without objection from the defense. It was only this file to which there was an objection, in which they raised an authenticity issue. They did not raise that authenticity issue with respect to any of the other files that came in.
Were those files supposedly from the same directorate?
They were from various directorates. The question...
And had those files come from Baghdad?
Yes, they had. They had come from the same...
And that testimony had come in?
Yes.
They were from Baghdad.
Now, Mr. Andrews' testimony was that he received these files from Mr. Aras Karim in early June. And there was evidence that the FBI was aware of the telephone records that were part of that file in May. Now, just the fact that Mr. Andrews received these in June is not inconsistent with the FBI having, from some other source, knowledge that these telephone records had been passed. And beyond that, I'm reluctant to say anything further, Your Honor, but direct you to some of the classified filings that were made before the trial, and that may answer your question or Mr. Durkin's question with respect to an alleged inconsistency between the recovery of this file in Baghdad in June and knowledge on the part of the government that those telephone records had been passed in May. Now, Judge Conlin admitted this file pursuant to the residual exception of the hearsay rule. I think that was legal. I think it was based upon the law of this circuit. As we suggest in our brief, however, I think there's some other bases for admission. I think the strongest one is perhaps the business record exception, but we suggest others in our brief as well. Judge Conlin was in a position to evaluate the testimony of this witness. She found Mr. Sargon credible. She found that he had a duty to report the activities that the IIS officers whose writings and reports were in the Baghdad file had a duty to report accurately their activities and the activities of others, and that it had circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness as required under Rule 807. Unless the court has any further questions regarding this issue with respect to the Baghdad file, I'm prepared. I do want to say that Mr. Durkin said that independent of the Baghdad file, we didn't have sufficient evidence with respect to Mr. DeMacy's conviction. I'm prepared to answer that or stand on my brief. I think the testimony of his associates with whom he had confided his activities on behalf of the IIS was certainly more than sufficient to sustain the conviction. He told his office mate that he had gone to Baghdad, where he had been solicited to gather and report on the activities of opposition members. So I think even independent of the Baghdad file, there is more than sufficient evidence to sustain the conviction.
Let's turn to the conspiracy conviction, because, you know, my question here is, if the defendant didn't know he had to register, how could he have engaged in a conspiracy to fail to register? And then I have a follow-up question relating to who he conspired with, because I think there's a problem with that as well.
On your first question, Your Honor, the law on 951, there's not a whole lot of it. It's the government's position that the knowledge requirement that is under 951 is that you have to know that you did not register. Not that you have to know that you are required to register, but that you know that you didn't register. And I think it's similar to a 1326 violation, an illegal reentry after having been deported. The knowledge requirement there is to know that you entered illegally, not that you were required to get the permission of the Attorney General to do so, or now I guess it's the Department of Homeland Security to do so. So the only analogous situation that we could come up with respect to this knowledge requirement was that. And it's our position that the knowledge requirement is just simply that the defendant know that he didn't register, not that he had a requirement to do so. And your follow-up question with respect to the
conspiracy. Didn't the government have to prove that the defendant and someone else joined together so that DeMacy could act as an agent without registering?
Yes.
And who is that individual?
There would be multiple people, Your Honor. First of all, Wafa Zaitawi, who was the person who provided DeMacy with the phone records that he then passed relating to the opposition figure. And all of the members of the IIS who were at the mission, Qasim Muhammad, Ahmed Saleh, the IIS officers who met with DeMacy and for whom he provided the press identification cards, and even IIS officers who were in Baghdad who were directing the IIS officers at the mission to direct DeMacy in his activities.
But how does that relate to his failure to register? the conspiracy, conspiring to act as an agent without registering. I mean, I understand what that evidence is and how that helped move forward the other count that he was charged with, the other count. I'm specifically looking at that conspiracy to fail to register.
Well, I think it would be, if so, it would be similar to if somebody was agreeing to bring in some illegal aliens who had previously been deported. Do they have to know that there's a requirement that an illegal alien get permission of the Attorney General before he reenters? Don't you have to look at the knowledge requirement of the person who's committing the substantive crime? And if the co-conspirator agrees that that substantive crime be committed, then there's a conspiracy.
Okay.
That's the best I can do.
All right. Well, was the jury instructed on the intent requirement for the conspiracy? How were they instructed? Just remind me of that.
I wish I could answer your question. I don't remember with respect to the conspiracy instructions.
Okay.
With respect to the remaining issues that Mr. Durkin did not address, I'm prepared to stand on my brief. Unless the court has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Ms. Peters, with regard, going back to the file again, It was presented for admission as a total package, was it not? I mean, no,
yes, Your Honor.
Not individually.
Government Exhibit 14 consisted of what's in our appendix to our brief. It was as a package.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Ms. Peters. Mr. Durkin.
If I could follow up on Judge Williams' question with respect to the instructions regarding the conspiracy, and I think the question is a valid one. I don't specifically have the instruction that was given. I have the one we requested, however, which was rejected, which was, and that's contained on page 40 of our brief. We had asked for an instruction that would have cured that issue specifically, and it was rejected. If I could, and if I could spend a minute talking about the knowledge, I don't agree with the government's analogy that it's like the guy bringing in the illegal aliens. They at least have to prove that person knew that these people had been previously deported. There is an added element of knowledge there. One of the things we pointed out in our brief, certainly in the reply, I'm not sure about the opening brief, is the fact that there's no evidence that Dumaze was acting in secret, other than the infamous lunch comment, which I get a kick out of, too. I mean, I find some of this testimony kind of comical. But one of the government's great pieces of evidence, they say, independent of the Baghdad file, is this conversation he has with his secretary where he's overheard saying something about going to lunch. Now, lunch is not a code word anywhere, but I think the inference was that he must have been talking about something other than lunch because it was a nefarious conversation. And he says to his secretary something like, never mind, it's none of your business. So I'm going to be a little more cautious talking to my secretary this afternoon. But the fact of the matter is that that's the kind of weakness in the whole thread of the evidence here, that that's the code. What I was, in response to your question, Judge Flom, I thought you were asking me about the code, and what I had said before was my recollection is the only thing about code in the Baghdad file are these names, that everybody got different names, and he identified code Sirhan as our guy, and I think he did identify a couple of other people. But there's nothing else about a code. And interestingly, and I as I said, Sargon's testimony I think helps us as much as it hurts us. If there was a code, how come there's nothing in there about the code? But more importantly, if he was acting under their control since 1999, how come this dossier, which is supposed to be complete, as Sargon says, how come it only has events around the time period of 2002? You know, everything Sargon says, you can take one way and then ask it the other way and say, what's that all about? Isn't that a classic authenticity question? See, this guy was really trying. One of the things I got a kick out of is he admitted on the stand he never saw this file till he showed up in America and was being pretried by the government. I guess this is what Judge Conlon was talking about when they were looking for somebody to come in and authenticate this stuff. They finally found him, and they showed him these documents, and he says, oh, well, you know, yeah, this is what they are. But how do they explain, if this is what Sargon says it's supposed to be, how do they explain, where's all the stuff from 99? Why does it only contain things about a brief period in 2002? And this suggestion that somehow, you know, I'm wrong for making a suggestion about something that I don't know about, I apologize, but I'm not, you know, I can't see secret evidence, I'm not a mind reader. But all the more, I'd love to see what that is. And I have to trust you guys to help me on that. What in God's name could they be talking about? You know, isn't it odd that they claim that some, I guess they're saying, that somehow in that classified stuff, there must have been something about what they knew about these phone records. Now, I don't know where that came from. Maybe Ahmad Shalabi, for all I know. But, you know, how ridiculous is that? What are we supposed to do about that? And secondly, if it is, then where's all this stuff from 99? I mean, I could go on.
With the absence of Ms. Durkin, of anything from 99 impact the issue of the authenticity of this file?
Yes, because what the government had to prove.
I mean, that's an argument issue, certainly, as to completeness. If the Sargon represents this is.
But what I think the government took advantage of cleverly was the fact that, as you correctly said, this was all presented as a package, as if this is it. Here's the dossier. This guy was really a spy. That's what's really wrong with this case, you want my opinion to begin with. They really tried to try it as a spy case, you know, as an espionage case, but it's kind of a reverse espionage case because he's giving them information about something about over there, people that aren't happy with people over there. This isn't a state secret case or anything like that. But they present it as a package, as if this is the whole dossier. That's what's wrong with it. You know, what if what was in there from 99 on was 52 clippings of the newspaper from that Dumézy published? Wouldn't that help? And might that not be the case? And what were they doing with him from 99 to 2002? Was he really just a source? Was he just somebody sympathetic? You know, and if, by the same token, and there's some real First Amendment issues here, I don't have any more time, but think about it for a second. What if they collected the file on Matt O'Connor? What if somebody showed up in court one day and said, I found these over in Baghdad, and here's a bunch of newspaper clippings from Matt O'Connor and a bunch of statements about telephone conversations. Would that be okay? Just say, well, we don't know where it came from. I got these in Baghdad, though, and here it is.
Thank you, Mr. Durkin. Ms. Peters, thanks to all counsel.